Hi there, and welcome to the Truly Horrible NBA Podcast. I'm your host, Connor Allen, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Daniel Porter.
Hi there. Thanks for listening. Excited to get back into it and talk about some bad NBA teams today. One in particular.
Yeah, so today our goal is we're going to start by breaking down. We're going to go through each of our five teams and kind of look at the history of their rebuild. And today we're going to start with the Phoenix Suns. We both talked a little about where we felt this rebuild began, and we both kind of looked, amazingly enough, that the catalyst for this rebuild was really the Amari Stoudemire signing with the New York Knicks and kind of the fall of those, you know, Steve Nash Suns teams, which is amazing because, you know, that's 8 years ago now. And I think this has got to be one of the longest, like, ongoing rebuilds.
Yep, that definitely makes sense as a bright line to look to, though. I mean, Amari left, and then Steve Nash was getting traded not too long after that, and they've been bad now for... Other than, I mean, they had that little blip where they were like the 9 or the 10 seed, even though everyone expected them to be horrible in 2014. But I don't think that really counts as like interrupting the rebuild. It kind of, part of the reason why it's been such a long rebuild is because of that year, I think. The fact that they showed just enough progress to continue to keep trying to move forward with that core. But it's still a continuous rebuild.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, that was the 2013-2014 season. Because remember, I mean, the Suns, they were supposed to be one of the worst teams in the league. That was the Wiggins draft when he was really being hyped up and everyone was talking about tanking, really. And they won like 48 games that year and they missed the playoffs somehow still. And it's just an example of a rebuild going awry because, like, an overreaction to short-term results, like, distorting the viewpoint of what the long-term outlook actually is.
Yep. All right, so you want to just dive in. We've got obviously talk about some of those different moves and what they could have done around 2014-15, but I think it makes sense to go through the moves chronologically, right?
Yep, absolutely. So starting, of course, we have Amari Stoudemire signing with the New York Knicks in the summer of 2010. And then really the next big move they had after that happened on December 18th, 2010, where they traded Earl Clark, Jason Richardson, Hedo Turkoglu for Vince Carter, Marcin Gortat, Mikal Petras, and a 2011 first-round pick.
See, I feel like that was a decent move, right? That just goes to show you would never see a first-round pick included in a trade like that in the 2018 NBA. But it was definitely a different league back then. In December 2010, like Jason Richardson and Hedo Turkoglu were still guys you wanted on your team, right? But still, like, I mean, Petras, Gortat, and first is a great haul, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And the fact of the matter is, like, none of Earl Clark, Jason Richardson, or Hedo Turkoglu was, like, a useful NBA player, like, 2 years after that trade, you know? And so it's one of these things where you should evaluate trades based on, like, the long-term value of the assets. And ultimately, like, Vince Carter is still good. Marcin Gortat is still good, you know? The 2011 first-round pick is still, like, a valuable asset 2 years later.
Was that So what happened to that first round pick? That wasn't the pick they used on Markieff Morris was their own pick, right?
Right. So moving forward to their next transaction on February 24th, 2011, they traded Goran Dragic and the 2011 first round pick that they got that last trade to Houston for Aaron Brooks.
A good trade. Yeah, especially, I mean, obviously they ended up getting Dragic back, and he, you know, was good for them, and then they traded him for future first and everything, but giving up Dragic, so a promising young player, and a first for Aaron Brooks is just never something you want to do.
Yeah, not good at all. And so then fast forwarding to the 2011 draft, they drafted Markieff Morris at 13. That worked out. I think that's good value at 13. Do you remember that Markieff was considered the significantly worse prospect than Marcus Morris, and then they went, like, Markieff went before Marcus.
Yeah,
and
that was a big surprise. Were back-to-back picks, right? And then yeah. Markieff has also been a, like, pretty clearly inferior NBA player, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think it's been up. So I think people would have classified Markieff as the better player to begin their careers, but I think Marcus is probably classified as better now, mostly because of this, you know, season with the Celtics and Markieff kind of having this, you know, his entire time in Washington kind of being the story of someone who has natural talent but doesn't really have, like, the full, you know, effort level to really unlock everything at all times.
I mean, that Markieff Morris should be exactly what the Wizards need. I mean, he should be a really good fit for their team, but he hasn't actually helped them. But either way, it's not like it was a bad draft pick at all.
No, definitely good value.
For 13.
And then all of the 2011-2012 season, they were very quiet. You know, they had small little moves, but nothing really worth reflecting on. And then the 2012 draft, they took Kendall Marshall at 13, which is kind of an example of what the 13th pick can be in, like, the negative side of things, you know? Like, that's a pretty...
Yeah. I mean,
Kendall Marshall.
You hear 13th pick, and you're like, all right, it's a lottery pick. Like, you're expecting to get somebody who's at least going to be a starter, but Kendall Marshall is an example of... I mean, it's not like he was even that much of a reach. I think in real time, that was a decent pick, but he's a journeyman point guard who's been out of the league now, and so not really a good investment for the Suns.
And that is just, I mean, it's not like this is some, like, huge bust at 13. I mean, it's not, like, what you want from the 13th pick. But the reality is, once you're talking about those those late lottery picks, they're a crapshoot. A bunch of guys are just going to be journeyman guys from those picks. And the point of, like, why those draft picks have value isn't that they always churn out a good player. It's just that for as many, you know, Kendall Marshalls there are at 13, you also have Devin Booker's at 13, you know, or Donovan Mitchell's at 13.
Yep. And that's really... that 2012 draft, was that the Giannis draft as well?
No, no. 2012 was the Anthony Davis MKG draft, okay. Damian Lillard draft.
Okay.
But yeah. And then, so then the big move of the 2012 offseason, though, really where, like, the rebuild fully goes into, like, full, you know, tilt is on July 11th, 2012, they trade Steve Nash to the Lakers for a 2013 first, a 2013 second, 2014 second, and then a 2018 first, which is the pick that the Sixers now own. Amazing trade. Really one of those things where, at the time, people didn't realize what a great haul it was. I mean, Steve Nash was 38. He was never actually very good for the Lakers.
I know. I can't believe, again, this would never happen anymore in the NBA. Like, it takes so much more to get first-round picks now than it did less than 10 years ago. But, I mean, two firsts and 2 seconds for a 38-year-old? I don't care if it is Steve Nash. Like, if you're the Suns, you got to do that trade 10 times out of 10.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really, I mean, that trade, a tangent on the Lakers, it's one of those trades that just has, like, hamstrung the Lakers and made the Lakers rebuild so much harder. But no one wants to evaluate trades about what they're going to do to teams 2 years in the future because everyone wants to freak out about the here and now. Because, I mean, that trade was just, people were so crazy about it. They were like, the Lakers have Steve Nash and Kobe Bryant.
They were such a super team.
Dwight Howard and a super team and everything. And they ended up not being that good because they had a bunch of aging guys. And it just, like, didn't quite work.
The
and
of fit course, was
they
terrible.
Did have injury problems.
The fit was terrible, yeah. Too, though. It just, it didn't work.
You know, our friend Joe, of course, always says that team was coming together at the end, and if Kobe hadn't got hurt, they would have, you know, won a title or whatever, but I don't buy that. So then, that offseason, they also signed Luis Scola and Goran Dragic, and then, I think most importantly, they signed Michael Beasley. Great moves. All great signings.
Yeah, I mean, that Dragic contract was a great contract. They got him for 4 years, $30 million, and he provided a ton of surplus value over it. Michael Beasley, I mean, just a friend and preferred kind of favorite player of this podcast, I think. Great guy to have on your team, okay. Especially if you're going to be a bad NBA team and you care about things like being entertaining. Michael Beasley will make you entertaining.
Dude, we're gonna have to connect with Mike and figure out when he wants to come on the pod because, you know, he really would be a great personality to come on for occasional guest appearances.
He hasn't been responding to my DMs, but I know he likes to take some time off after the season and just unwind. So, you know, maybe later this offseason we'll be able to get Mike Bees on the pod.
Yeah, and he'll definitely, I mean, you'll be surprised when you talk to Michael Beasley about NBA team building because he really has nuanced takes. It's one of the things I really appreciate about Mike.
Future GM, I've always said.
Agreed, absolutely. And one of those guys, like, most people wouldn't expect that, but he's going to be one of the greats. So then, also in July 27th, 2012, there was a pretty complicated trade with a bunch of different pieces moving, but the main points that impacted the Suns is that the Suns traded Robin Lopez to New Orleans, and then Wesley Johnson came to the Suns. You know, ultimately, I think Robin Lopez ended up being the better player.
He was. He was. I mean, if you want to look at that trade through a 2018 lens, it's probably a bad trade. But that's just because Wesley Johnson was a huge bust. But in 2012, he still was like a recent, very high draft pick, had some untapped potential maybe. So I don't mind that trade from a like in real time process based standpoint. But the results, they didn't really pan out.
Yep, completely agreed. And I do. I really don't have anything to add because I agree completely. And then they signed PJ Tucker. Another great signing, actually. You know, just
diamond in the rough. You know, they went and found PJ Tucker.
Yep. And so, but then all that leads into, and then they played the 2012-13 season. And once again, not very many big moves happened during the 2012-13 season. But then on May 7th, 2013, Ryan McDonough was hired as GM. And I think this is really where the true rebuild that the Suns have been going through, like, fully begins. You know, like, all that that we've just talked about is kind of the lead into this rebuild and how the team came to be. But, you know, the Ryan McDonough tenure is really this rebuild. So I think from this point on, we're going to try to grade every major move they made, and kind of talk through and kind of see. Because I think we both have a viewpoint on Ryan McDonough that he does some really, really smart stuff and he does some really, really dumb stuff.
Yep.
And it's just about, you know, ultimately we both think he's done a pretty good job, but there have been some really bad moves that have really set them back.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, because McDonough's had his job for so long, considering how much the team has struggled. He's been the GM there for 5 years now in a league where you see heavy turnover in those kinds of positions. So it's like he's great at buying himself time, you know, like you were saying, he's made some moves we're really in favor of. But I mean, if you look at his, I mean, he hired Jeff Hornacek, but then his first real move as GM was to draft Alex Len with the fifth pick in the 2013 draft, which that's been a disaster. There's really no way to sugarcoat that.
What grade are you giving that pick?
I guess a D minus.
Yeah, so I gave it an F. It was really bad in real time. Now, look, I want to make this clear. Every grade that I'm going to talk about in terms of draft pick is going to be a grade based on the results that came of it for the most part, while taking some of like the mindset going into the pick. But my general stance on drafting, and I think your general stance too, is that it's almost entirely a crapshoot, and there's certain guys who you should probably avoid because it just kind of seems like it'll never work. But for the most part, I don't really grade people based on their draft record because I just think it's throwing darts at a dartboard for the most part. But I will give that pick an F because it was a horrible pick.
Yep.
And it worked out horribly.
And he's played out his 4-year rookie contract now, and we do not expect the Suns to extend his qualifying offer. So Alex Len will probably still be in the league next year on some kind of a make good, but I doubt it'll be with the Phoenix Suns.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, will he even be a backup center next year, or is he going to come in and be someone's like third center?
You can't play him right now. I mean, it depends on what your aspirations are as a team. If you're a bad team anyway, then why not? But if you think you're going to win some games, you can't give regular rotation minutes to Alex Len.
That's just insane. I mean, the fifth pick, and he's coming up
4 years in.
Just complete zero. But then his next move, I mean, just a classic example of the McDonough roller coaster. His next move is he basically turned Jared Dudley and a second-round pick into Eric Bledsoe, which, like, an A-plus even. You know, that was just such amazing value. You know, Bledsoe was kind of undervalued because he was on the Clippers and he had a reduced role, and just a great trade.
Yep, and I mean, Bledsoe, he's one of those guys, he almost reminded me of like what Terry Rozier is doing right now, where you could just see the writing on the wall that he was going to be a solid starter, but he was blocked internally. So, you know, if you can get good value for a guy like that, which in the case of that trade, they definitely did. Yeah, smart move.
Yeah, that's a great, I hadn't even thought of that, because I love that idea of Terry Rozier being very similar to Eric Bledsoe. What would your grade be for that move?
I mean, it's hard not to give it an A.
Yeah. And then on July 12th, 2013, the next move, once again, is when the Suns signed Isaiah Thomas to that offer sheet with the Kings, a 4-year, $30 million contract that was descending, which was my favorite part about that contract at the time. I always think that rebuilding teams should front load contracts as much as possible because, like, it's a good way to enhance the value of your future cap space.
Yeah. And after Steph Curry's famous deal, his second contract, that Isaiah Thomas contract is probably one of the on the short list of the best bargain deals in the NBA in the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, he provided a ton of surplus value on that contract.
Even though the last year of the contract, he literally provided like zero to negative value.
That being this past season.
So much. Yeah. It's still so much surplus value from the prior years that I completely agree. So I gave that signing an A as well. I just think it's one of the best contracts signed. Hard to give it anything less. And then July 27th, 2013, traded Luis Scola to the Pacers for Gerald Green, Miles Plumlee, and a 2014 first. I mean,
yes.
Fuck, man.
Yes, if you're getting a first for Luis Scola, sign me up. Dude, the old NBA was crazy. Teams used to just throw first-round picks around for role players all the time. What a league.
Oh my god! I mean, I remember when this trade happened. I was so upset. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, it was so bad at the time because Luis Scola. I think Luis Scola was like 32 at this point or something like that, 31. Like he was not a young Luis Scola at this point. And Gerald Green had, the Pacers had signed him to that 3-year, $12 million contract after he'd had that year with the Nets, and he hadn't been great, but I mean, Gerald Green's been a productive player since then. Like, since this trade happened, Gerald Green has been a better player in the NBA than Luis Scola.
Yeah.
Almost certainly.
Yep. I mean, and Gerald Green's had a crazy career. And they got another first, and that first was eventually packaged in order to help them get Marquise Chris, right? That's how that worked?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And then they got Miles Plumlee, too, who ended up not being any good, really. But, well, I mean, here's the thing. He ended up being good enough to get a 4-year, $50 million contract, you know, and that got him on his rookie contract, you know? So, I mean, that's a bad contract now, but Plumlee was a first-round pick. So the Pacers, in essence, sent their first-round pick from, like, the year prior, plus another first for Luis Scola.
Yeah, you don't love that. If you're a Pacers fan.
Yeah, so I mean that's an A for me. That trade was such an A for the Suns. And then unfortunately the next move, another example of Ryan McDonough just not really handling things very well. He waived Michael Beasley.
I don't know what that was all about, but yeah, they waived Beasley on September 3rd, 2013, only 1 year into the 3-year, $18 million contract they'd signed him to the previous summer. Well, it's also weird because why would you just eat that salary when you're not really likely to be good anyway? Also, now it's 5 years later and Michael Beasley is actually still contributing to an NBA team. So maybe they just thought there was no way he was going to help them win and it was just cut their losses. But clearly they bailed too early on Bees.
They did. There was partial guarantees on the contract. And also, there was, after they waived him, they were actually able to further reduce the guarantees in the contract. I don't know the exact details on that, but they didn't end up having $6 million of dead cap money for both those 2 years. But still, I think if you're gonna be bad, have Michael Beasley on your team. He's fine.
Exactly. I wish I could say that to every bad GM from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah.
If you're gonna be bad, just have Michael Beasley on your team.
Absolutely. And then on October 25th, 2013, they traded Marcin Gortat to the Wizards for a 2014 first, which eventually becomes Tyler Ennis. What, once again, it's not about what the pick becomes. It's about
the asset in the trade. Yeah. Well, also, yeah. I mean, that just makes that Turkoglu-Jason Richardson trade look even better because they basically got two firsts for those guys.
Yep. And, I mean, Marcin Gortat has been pretty good. It's one of those trades, actually, like, I did not like it at the time for the Wizards, but it's pretty hard to argue with, like, the results they've gotten from Gortat and the value they've gotten. But it was also a great trade for the Suns based on what they were trying to do. You know, this was heading into that 2013-14 season where it really seemed like they were just going to be horrible. Like, these trades are why we thought they were going to be horrible. And then,
yep. You
know, Bledsoe kind of just took a leap, and they were so much better than anyone could have expected.
And Dragic, too, was amazing that season. Yep. But, so because of all these moves, wheeling and dealing by McDonough, they ended up with 3 first-round picks in the 2014 draft, 14, 18, and 27, which, I mean, it's not like those are high picks or anything. It's like the situation that Brooklyn is in this year. But, I mean, still, when you're bad, you need bites at the apple. And so they took TJ Warren, number 14, who is still on the team, still pretty solid. If they were to trade him, they would at least get something back. They took Tyler Ennis at 18, which, I don't know, jury's kind of still out. I mean, Ennis could be a useful or somewhat useful NBA player.
Well,
but
I mean, I think you have to consider that, like, sort of disappointing, but it's not, I mean, the point is, once again, it's not, like, a horrible pick. And, like, you know, that's kind of a fairly normal outcome for the 18th pick.
Okay. Yep, I agree. And then Bogdan Bogdanovic was really solid for number 27.
Right. Well, of course, they don't actually get Bogdan. I mean, they traded him before they ever had him. But, yeah, completely agreed. Great pick. I gave the Warren pick a B+. I gave the Ennis pick a D. And I gave the Bogdan pick an A. And once again, this is hindsight, you know, it's 2020. But that's what I'm grading on for these picks, and it's not really what I think about them. Also, I want to make a note. I just realized I actually put it down in the list wrong. Actually, this, and I was thinking about this while we were talking. The Suns signed Isaiah Thomas actually July 12th, 2014, not 2013.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
So that was because this something off about the timing of this. Isaiah Thomas wasn't around for this year, and that is why. So I was actually just correct that, but so he came in this following summer after the draft of TJ Warren, Tyler Ennis, and Bogdan Bogdanovic.
Yep. That's when they put together that famous 3-point guard lineup that everyone loved and was extremely successful.
Well, or something. people did not love it, but I still think it was sort of visionary and could be like a future thing that exists in the NBA. Is you really do want two guys who can truly handle the ball in the court at all times, and there's no reason to not have like 2 point guard lineups. And like the Mavs famously used them all the time.
David Kahn was ahead of his time when he drafted Rubio and Johnny Flynn.
Yeah, absolutely. And then on September 24th, 2014, the Suns re-signed Eric Bledsoe to a 5-year, $70 million contract. I mean, that's a good contract. That they end up, you know, they got surplus value from it for a few years and then traded it for a first to Milwaukee. But I think the interesting part about the Eric Bledsoe signing was his long holdout. Because he didn't sign that deal until the end of September.
Yeah, and that, I mean, look, it doesn't bode well. It doesn't speak well to where you're at as a franchise when you have guys holding out. I think part of the issue was Bledsoe was upset about all the different point guards. And also, I think it's just hard to pay a guy when what you expect from him is more than what he's actually shown. You know, anytime we see that in the NBA, it can lead to some imbalanced and drawn out negotiations. But Bledsoe at that point hadn't actually been that, like, that star that they were expecting. But they just knew that he had the potential. That's why they brought him there. So I don't know.
Yeah, and he was really good in that 2013-14 season. I mean, he's one of the main reasons they overachieved so badly, and they really stood out. But I think also, I mean, that holdout, as much as it was said something about the Suns, it also just was, you know, I mean, Bledsoe was a Rich Paul client. That was really the first time Rich Paul did that, like, extended holdout to extract as big of a contract for a restricted free agent as possible. And, I mean, though that contract ended up being sort of a bargain just because the NBA financial landscape transformed so much over the next few years, still a really good job by Bledsoe and his agent to like maximize leverage and get a good contract. So, I mean, as much as I like that contract for the Suns, and I ultimately would give that contract the way it worked out an A, also a really good job from Bledsoe and his agent to get that contract. An interesting case where it really worked out well for both sides.
Definitely.
And then on September 29th, 2014... a big addition where they signed Zoran Dragic to, you know, appease Goran Dragic.
Yeah, they were both packaged together in that trade, which is pretty funny. Zoran isn't still in the league, is he? He must be playing in Europe somewhere by now.
Yeah, I don't think he's in the league. He's definitely not on a roster this past year, but maybe he's in the G League. I don't think so, though. I assume he's in Europe, back in Europe.
Yep. That makes sense. But anyway, you know, sometimes you want to sign the brother of your best player. I don't really mind that. It's fun to have family ties and family connections. This is when the Suns were doing that weird, like, we need all the brothers on the team together thing, too. Like, they had the Morris brothers and the Dragic brothers. And
it was great. I was super into that. Yeah. I was like, this is awesome. They should be trying to get the Lopez twins.
I mean, obviously, I'm not surprised that it didn't work. Like, it's just the classic kind of thing that you try to do when you're... The other Suns gimmick I loved was their high-five bit. They went into the season being, like, one of these years, 14, I think, counting all the high-fives. Zach Lowe wrote about it during his preseason call about them, but they would, like, keep track of which guys on the team were high-fiving each other the most. And I think it dated back to Steve Nash, who was a famously prolific high-fiver. But they just thought that there was this, like, ephemeral, unquantifiable benefit to high-fiving a lot on the court. But it did not really help them in the wins and losses.
I feel like the argument acts like their mindset must have been that actually, like, high fives suggest something about, like, team chemistry, you know. Definitely. So it's not actually that high fives benefit, but
they counted the high fives that year. Like, imagine that you're an intern in the Suns analytics or front office and you're counting high fives. That would be really humbling.
And everyone around you is being like, it's so cool you get to work for, like, a professional sports team. Like, you're living the dream, but you're just there, like, recording every high five.
You're like, was that a high five? Does it still count if it's down low?
You're like, wait, they missed. Like, does that count? Like, is the attempt what matters, or is it really the contact? Do we need the skin-to-skin contact?
Exactly.
Oh, the Suns. Yeah, the Suns. Going through this rebuild, I was really reminded how much, like, how many fun, interesting aspects of this Suns rebuild there have been, and what, like, an interesting, quirky team they've been for the past 7-8 years.
That's why we got to do this pod, so that people know, you know, not to just trash bad teams, but there's always something interesting going on in every NBA situation.
Absolutely. So then their next move was January 9th, 2015. They traded the Minnesota Timberwolves top 12 protected first to Boston for Brandon Wright. Now, it would convert it to 2 seconds if it wasn't in the top 12 this year, and this is the year the Wolves had, like, the second worst record in the NBA, and they got Karl Towns, so they really traded 2 seconds for Brandon Wright. But the issue is, like, they weren't very good. They were, like, okay, and at the trade deadline, they ended up sort of blowing things up. I just, like, this is where McDonough sort of loses me, where they buy into this idea, like, they were sort of good in 2013-14, and they start, like, sort of trying to compete now while also trying to, like, grow their young core and everything. And that just really doesn't work unless you have, like, just, like, an excess of assets like the Boston Celtics do currently. And, like, this is one of the trades where McDonough just loses me, where it's not, like, this isn't necessarily, like, that harmful of a move. It's just 2 seconds. But still, like, valuable seconds.
Yeah, I would give that trade, like a C minus. I mean, look, on January 9th, 2015, they're trading draft picks for Brandon Wright, who's an established veteran meant to help you win in the short term. Then 6 weeks later, on February 19th, 2015, they're trading Dragic and Thomas and being like, all right, this isn't going to work. Like, let's try to get some firsts and rebuild again. Or continue to rebuild. But then it's like, why did you give up those seconds 6 weeks ago for Brandon Wright? Like, Brandon Wright is not a future-looking asset.
Right. And then also, not only did they do that, like, they trade for Brandon Wright, give up picks, and then, you know, they trade away Dragic and Isaiah Thomas, but then they traded the Lakers pick for Brandon Wright. You know, it's just this classic example of, it was like, what are they doing?
They're, so
like,
making bad.
Some moves. Yeah, and I was just like, look, if they had just not traded for Brandon Wright, and they had not traded... for
Brandon Knight? If they not traded Brandon for either Knight. Of the Brandon Knights that they traded for, yeah. They would have been in way better shape.
Right, or on the reverses, if they hadn't traded Goran Dragic and they hadn't traded Isaiah Thomas and they had traded for Brandon Wright and they maybe traded for Brandon Knight too, like, they're in better shape too when your moves are aligned in the same vision. You know, at least then you're really going all in on trying to be good now. Like, the point is just that, like, your move should have, like, a consistent logical flow where you're clearly trying to do a certain thing with the team. You're trying to be good, or you're trying to rebuild, and you're trying to acquire future assets. And when you're trying to do both, it almost always backfires.
Yeah. I mean, you just need some kind of internal consistency, and you need to stay the course. You know, if they really thought that sort of like multi-point guard lineup, I mean, look, that probably would have worked pretty well, actually. I remember they got killed for it during the 14-15 season. It doesn't help that they didn't have buy-in from the guys who were actually like the three-headed monster of point guards. But it's kind of an interesting team if you look at it from like a modern NBA lens. If you could have Isaiah Thomas and Bledsoe and Dragic all out there, and then maybe like a stretch four and a shot blocking five. I mean, there's something there. But, of course, they didn't actually ever put it together or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And there's a reason I think the two-point guard lineup was really interesting. But kind of like just going through those trades, they made at the trade deadline. So they traded Zoran and Goran Dragic to the Heat for 2017 first, top seven protected. That's the 16th pick in this year's draft. And then the 2021 unprotected first.
It is an A, but we also can't really evaluate that trade yet without knowing what the 2021 first is. I mean, granted, not having to pay Dragic's next contract and getting two firsts for him when he was sort of still being seen as a star was, I mean, yeah, that's a great move. It's just,
and he was an expiring contract. Like, he became a free agent that summer. I mean, I think regardless of if that 2021 pick becomes the 30th pick in the draft, I still give that trade an A. Like, it was, because it's about the upside of what that pick could become. You know, that's how you have to evaluate it, like, what the assets could become. And just getting two firsts for an expiring contract is remarkable. You know, that would, once again, we talked a lot about the old NBA. It's amazing how, you know, 3 years ago, a trade like that could still happen. And just never in a million years could happen now.
No. I mean, you don't, that, yeah, we, I think we talked about this on our last podcast, but that could be the last sort of, like, truly unprotected first round pick that we see traded in the NBA.
Yeah.
Doesn't really happen anymore.
And then they traded the Lakers pick for Brandon Knight.
Awful. Probably one of the worst trades of the last 5 years.
Yeah, this is an F for me. It was an F from the very
capital
beginning.
Capital bold-faced F.
Yeah. Big, big F. Do you remember, I mean, our buddy Joe was freaking out that the Sixers didn't try to trade for Brandon Knight instead of the Lakers pick. He was like, they could have just sent MCW for Brandon Knight. And it was like, why would you want? Idea that Brandon Knight was ever good.
We're gonna have to bring Joe on to defend himself at some point. We can't just be taking pot shots at him. But I do think that Joe wanted some more vets in the mix for the Sixers at the time.
Yeah, and Joe is our friend who is like super anti-process, super anti-rebuilding. Like, would ride or die for a team that was winning like 41 games every single year. Like, if Joe was a GM, he would be on the
treadmill,
the compete for the 8th seed. Yeah. And, like, you know what? Like, I actually, like, there is certainly like an argument that is just like a different way to view what a team should be striving to do, and that's okay. I think we both are kind of psychotic championship or bust mindsets, and so we always evaluate things through which move teams to being like true contenders, and that's just a different perspective. But agree, we'll have to bring Joe on at some point to defend his horrible perspective. And then the last trade was Isaiah Thomas to the Celtics for a first round pick that became like the 28th pick, I want to say.
I guess that's a bad trade, especially given that they had Thomas signed to that great contract for that rest of that season and then three more seasons, right? That was still the first year he was on that deal. So, yeah, I mean, I don't particularly like that trade. But again, if you're the Suns and you're really trying to blow it up and be bad, at least getting a first back for IT is decent.
Yeah, and I
return.
Do wonder.
It's a very late first, though, and they knew it was going to be a really late first when they made the deal. It's not like there was that much upside.
Nope. But I do wonder also, like, the thing I feel like we have to ask about it is, you know, given this, what we saw with Isaiah Thomas in Cleveland and the way things went negative there and the reports you heard about him in Sacramento, you do have to wonder if partially why they traded Isaiah Thomas was a locker room issue. If he was one of the guys who was really causing issues about the three-point guard setup and he was really unhappy and, like, he was causing locker room problems and they wanted to get him out of there. And if that's the case, then getting a first for a guy who you view as, like, a locker room cancer is still pretty good. You know, it's just tough. Like, that's why I always think, like, as much as we can evaluate trades and everything, there are certain things that are impossible to truly
know. If you don't know, if you don't know what the situation was behind the scenes, then that's different. Yeah. So that was it for the 2014-15 season.
Yep.
Tumultuous, kind of heavy year. After being unexpectedly good the previous year, 14-15 was when they had to come to terms with the fact that maybe they still sucked.
But also, like, they still didn't quite understand that they sucked, you know? Like, because, right. I mean, that was really a truly, I mean, the 2014-15 Sun season, just, like, going through that list of transactions, everything that happened is just, like,
I'm tired.
It was a batshit insane. Like, that is, I mean, once again, how can you not think this stuff is interesting after we just went through, like, that list of moves and all the crazy stuff that happened? Like, I don't know, man. I don't understand people who think that it's only fun to follow the very best teams. I think the most interesting stuff in the NBA almost always happens with the bottom teams.
Yep. So the sort of saving grace, highlight of McDonough's tenure, and probably what ended up saving his job, was drafting Devin Booker with the 13th pick in the 2015 draft. And if you can get a star with the 13th pick, it's kind of, you see what Donovan Mitchell this year too. I mean, it can really transform the trajectory of an entire franchise.
Yeah, just A-plus for me, just amazing pick. I loved the pick at the time, and he's been even better than you could have ever imagined. I do think it's interesting. What about the fact that the Suns managed to pick 13th three out of five drafts? Like, what are the chances of that?
Yeah, it doesn't, you know, they were just like, doesn't bode super well.
It's just, I mean, that's not really where you want to be picking, but, I mean, it did end up working out because they hit this. I mean, once again, you can hit on the 13th pick. Devin Booker, Donovan Mitchell, perfect examples, but like, the data shows that you're going to have a better chance of hitting on a star the higher you pick. And that's what we're always going to reiterate. It's not about that you can't have a positive outcome from other things. It's that you always want to take the path of the highest probability of success. And so picking at 13, you're just not very likely to have, you know, a lot of success there. But then, after the Booker pick, they just once again do stuff where it's just like, what are you... I mean, this is the frustrating thing for me, is they do so many smart things where they're making really smart rebuild moves, and then they try to jumpstart things, and they get over-anxious, and they really want to, like, dive in and get back to contending, and it all falls apart. Because, you know, because summer 2015, first they signed Tyson Chandler to a four-year, $52 million contract.
Ugh.
And then they traded Reggie Bullock, Danny Granger, and Marcus Morris to the Pistons just to clear out cap space, because they were just, like, they cleared out the cap space for LaMarcus Aldridge before he agreed to sign there. I mean, they gave away Marcus Morris for nothing. Marcus Morris became Avery Bradley. And, like, Avery Bradley was a piece in the Blake Griffin trade. Like, I mean, these things have value, and it's just...
Yeah, it is pretty sad. I mean, some of that, too, for all we know, could have been coming from their owner, Robert Sarver, and him wanting to speed up the timeline. But it's like, if even you add Tyson Chandler and LaMarcus Aldridge to the rest of that team that they had there, that wouldn't have been a good team. Like, that wasn't...
It would have been, like, the sixth seed, seventh, like, you know, at best, you know? And they're just like, I mean, why are you going all in to be the sixth seed and be, like, building around LaMarcus Aldridge, who's, like, in his 30s at that point? I mean, the Tyson Chandler contract for me is just, like, a hard F. I'm not, like, and I'm not someone who's such, like, a process ideologue, rebuild ideologue, that I think you shouldn't waste any roster spots on veterans.
But you don't need to spend $50 million on veterans. Yeah.
You don't need to spend $50 million, and much more important, you don't need to spend 4 years. I mean, I would be fine if they'd given Tyson Chandler a 1 year, $25 million contract even. Like, hell, like, it doesn't really matter to me that much how much you spend on 1 year. It's always about just making sure that that money comes off the book for the next summer.
You got to keep that flexibility.
Yep, exactly. And so, and then the trade, it's just, once again, like, salary dump for a guy, like, to clear out cap space for a guy you don't even sign. It's just, like, a classic, like, not smart move. Like, you just, like, you wait to do that salary dump until the guy has confirmed that he's coming there. You know, you're always going to be able to find a dump if you're trading away good players. It's not like these are bad contracts they traded, you know. They're good contracts. They shouldn't.
Excuse me. Also, I mean, they would be kind of screwed if LaMarcus did go there. I mean, that would still be a terrible team, and they would have even more salary. Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, the core would have been, like, I mean, they would have been, like, it would have been, like, Tyson Chandler, LaMarcus Aldridge. I mean, Eric Bledsoe would have been there. And then, like, Booker would have been, like, the young guy, like, showing promise and everything, but, like, Warren would have been there, but, like,
Morris twins, about, or like, just Markieff, actually, because Marcus Morris was gone.
Yep, and, but the problem is Markieff was pissed at this point. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, trading Marcus Morris sent Markieff off the edge with the Suns organization. It's just...
True. Well, yeah, that's why they've been bad for 7 years, I guess. But, yeah, it just speaks again to that inconsistent track record of Ryan McDonough.
Yep. So then on February 1st, 2016, they fired Jeff Hornacek and made Earl Watson the interim head coach.
I mean, Hornacek seems like he's probably a better NBA head coach than Watson, although they've both now been fired again since February 2016. So, yeah, that's that. Maybe neither of them are good coaches. I don't know. It's hard to tell. Hard to tell who's a good coach when they're coaching a terrible team also.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed. Yeah. I just think my issue with the Jeff Hornacek firing and making Earl Watson interim head coach, that they made him head coach and then fired him like a year later after they officially made him head coach. It's just one of those things where, like, much like we talked about last podcast about when you have a young prospect, you really want to be all in on them and be patient with them until you're fully out. Like, you really should be more patient with your head coaches too. And it just, if you're ready to fire Earl Watson a year after you made him the full-time head coach, like, you probably should have done more due diligence.
What were they expecting? Like, what were they expecting from Earl Watson that he didn't do? You gave him a roster of a bunch of teenagers and Tyson Chandler. Like,
and you, like, had him purposely lose in 2016 or 2017. I don't know, what year is it? 2016. No, it's 2018. 2017. 2016, 2017, they purposely lost at the end of the year. That's when they shut down Bledsoe and everything. And then they fired Earl Watson 3 years into 17-18.
Three games in.
Just, I don't get it, really. But moving on to a trade I actually think was a really good move for them at the time, is they traded, on February 18, 2016, they traded Markieff Morris to the Wizards for 2016 first. What I liked about this trade is just Markieff Morris was such a malcontent at this point, and things were so bad that just getting a guy like Markieff Morris, who I don't view as that valuable of a player, getting a first for him when things, like, when he was causing that money, like, public relations problems as well, was a really good job by McDonough, I think.
Yep. Oh yeah. I mean, you had to get him out of there, and usually once other teams know a guy is trying to leave, that really pushes his value down. But in that case, I guess the Wizards just really wanted to push for the playoffs, and yeah, it's a good deal. First, ultimately, was that part of the Chris trade too?
So that first, what was that first? Let me see here.
Did it convey? Must have conveyed. I bet it was. I think it was lottery protected.
Yeah, it must have. I think that became the 13th pick. Which was in the Chris trade, yeah. Did the Wizards miss the playoffs that year? Washington. I think that did become the 13th pick. So it was a 2016 pick, and it definitely wasn't 28, because it was top 9 protected. So yeah, I think that became... I mean, they got the 13th pick from Markieff Morris. I'd forgotten it was that good of a pick.
Yeah, that's crazy, actually. And then, I mean, we can kind of segue to the draft, I guess, talking about that too, but they made Earl Watson the full-time head coach at the end of the 2015-16 season. And then the 2016 draft, they came into the draft with the 4, 13, and 28th picks. They took Dragan Bender at number 4, and then they traded Bogdan Bogdanovic, the 13 and the 28, to the Kings for the 8, and used that pick to take Marquise Chris. So this jury's definitely still out on these moves. I mean, I think that Chris was a great value for the 8 spot. But obviously during the time he's actually spent in the NBA, he's been quite bad. And Dragan Bender, both these guys still have potential. I'm more of a fan of Bender, but he doesn't do enough right now. He's not really active or involved enough when he's on the court. And the lineups that have Chris and Bender together have been an absolute disaster. So if you draft two guys with the 4th and the 8th pick, you hope that they can play together at some point in their careers, and that does not seem particularly likely for Bender and Chris right now.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the Bender pick at the time. I was high on him as a prospect. It hasn't worked out that well. You know, I would give that pick like a C- right now. I mean, still too early to tell, of course, with this stuff. And he definitely could turn around, but it's hard to be that happy with that value at 4. And then I was really high on trading up for Marquise Chris, because I'm a sucker for those guys with all the athleticism who just have this like high upside, because I'm all about like doing things with the highest variance, with the highest upside is always a good move, because it's so hard to win an NBA championship that you just need to have like that upside. But when you look at that trade now, you have to think it didn't work out well for the Suns. I mean, Bogdan Bogdanovic is the best player in that trade by a fairly significant margin, I feel like.
Yeah.
And the Suns sent out 13 and 28.
Yeah, that seems to me like one of those trades where it was good process, bad results.
Yep, and so I'm not going to kill the Suns for that. You know, it didn't work out, but I think like the idea of it was good. Like, and I liked the idea, like a Bender Chris, it was smart in a twofold way of, you know, one, like maybe that's just like it could have been a new age front line where like that was the 4 and 5 and those guys, you know, could move on the perimeter and like rebound and shoot and pass. And there was the idea that like, wow, you could really just have like a new age front line. Or the idea was, well, we're just doubling down on taking two guys who play the same position.
And at least one of them will end up good.
And it might not work out either, but I still like that draft. I felt like was smart at the time, and I'm definitely not going to kill them.
Yeah,
for that draft
I think both those guys. I mean, I definitely think Bender and maybe even Chris will eventually be solid NBA players, but they just seem like the kind of guys where it's not really going to come together until their second contract, and they might not actually be on the Suns anymore. So that's kind of tough.
Seems totally.
Especially
possible.
Chris. If Chris does get it, it's going to take him like 6 years. Yeah,
dude, Marquise Chris. If he was on the Celtics, he would be like an all-star.
Sure, or at least a solid contributor. Like, a Marquise Chris comparison to me that makes sense is like Brandon Wright, where he was this super athletic guy who seemed disappointing, but then eventually realized how to he's never going to be a star, but how to play a role with his athleticism.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I like that comparison. I mean, they're not quite similar players just because Wright was a little taller and like his whole thing was just like that massive wingspan, but yeah, that's an interesting comparison. I do like that. And then in free agency, in 2016, they signed Jared Dudley to a 3-year, $30 million contract. This is another F for me. Like, this is just the classic example of you can't give a veteran 3 years when you're rebuilding. Give Jared Dudley 1 year 18 over giving him 3 years 30. You know, it's just...
I mean, look, I'll argue that it's not an F because I think Jared Dudley does a ton for you behind the scenes. I would give that trade or that signing like a C-, D+. But, I mean, the 3 years committed money, it clogs up your books. Jared Dudley was like one of their more effective players this past season. He's obviously not good enough to help you win, but he's not really like a tank commander. He's not still going to be around when your team is good. It's just, yeah, it didn't make a whole lot of sense. Maybe part of it was that they like Jared Dudley so much they want to try and keep him in the organization after he retires. I mean, he's jumped around a lot, but was on some of those Phoenix Steve Nash teams too when he first came in the league.
Yeah, and I mean, I get that. That makes sense. But it's just, I mean, I just think Jared Dudley would have happily signed like a 1-year, $18 million contract. You know, I just have a hard time believing, like, because that's so much more salary in the first year. I just think that he would be like, oh, I could make $12 million over my next contract easily over the next 2 years or whatever at that point in time, especially with the way money was flowing in 2016. And so it's just, once again, it's just you don't want to lock yourself into long veteran contracts when you're rebuilding, because it's all about the flexibility. And having veterans is really good. And I think that one of the flaws of the Sixers process was never having, like not having a couple veterans around always, because I really do think there's value in it. you don't need to be giving these guys massive contracts for them to be good veterans. You can be bringing in veterans for $4 million a year, and they're just as valuable as a guy who's making $20 million a year. Because it's really about, like, having guys who've been in the league and know what it's like, not about having guys who are, like, contributing and helping your team win.
Yep, I agree. So the 16-17 season was a huge disaster for the Suns, obviously. They were awful. They were truly horrible. They were everything that this podcast exists to celebrate and analyze.
Oh, yeah.
They shut down Eric Bledsoe for, like, the last third of the season with fake injuries, helping to bring about some of the NBA's tanking reforms, I think, and also poisoning the well in terms of their interactions with Bledsoe to the point where he was clearly not going to be able to stay with the team anymore, even though they didn't trade him until the following fall.
So. Yeah, I think the one thing that's weird to me is, why didn't they trade Bledsoe at the 2016-17 trade deadline?
I guess they must, you know, not have got offers they liked, but I completely agree that you know, that was time. It was a good time. Or even like last summer, why come back into the 17-18 season with Bledsoe still on the team? Who thought that was a good idea?
I just have a hard time believing Bledsoe wasn't communicating he was unhappy if he was willing to tweet out publicly something like that, you know? So it's just like, if he was communicating he was unhappy over the summer and it was clear that you guys weren't really going to be good this coming year anyways, like, why weren't you trying to move him over the summer? Like, I completely agree. It just doesn't make sense to me. But anyways, you know, they eventually traded him and actually got an okay return. But the 2017 draft, so they drafted Josh Jackson at 4 and Devin Reed at 32.
Solid draft.
So I view the Josh Jackson pick as like a B+ right now. You know, I mean, I don't think, I just like, my basic stance is I have a really hard time saying I would want anyone who's drafted like in the few picks right after Jackson more than Jackson moving forward. Like, I don't think I would want, I wouldn't want Fox more. I don't think I would want Jonathan Isaac more.
Isaac is a tough push. One. Isaac and Markkanen, it's like, I wouldn't be surprised if they had better careers than Jackson, but I don't blame the Suns for liking Jackson more as a prospect. And we've talked about Jackson before in our last podcast, but we definitely think he's got a ton of potential in the NBA, at least as like a super role player.
Yep. And so I just think, I mean, I think you have to be, oh, look, is Josh Jackson, are you going to look back and think that was amazing value at 4? Maybe not, but I don't think it's bad value either, and I do think he fits in well with the team. I like that pick. And then Devin Reed, you know, played a little. You know, he's under contract. We'll see. You know, that was a high second. It'll be disappointing if he doesn't come anything, you know, because those like, that, like, 30 to 40 range of picks in the second, like, those are valuable picks.
Oh, yeah.
You know, seconds become unvaluable pretty quickly. You know, like, actually, like, seconds in the 50s are almost completely useless, you know, so rare that someone becomes valuable who's picked there. But, those 30 to 40 picks, like, those are valuable picks. Guys, every single year, there's a good, like, couple good players taken there. So, you know, you gotta be a little disappointed with what you've gotten from Reed so far, but it's not, I'm not ready to write him off yet either.
I agree with all of that. Then, they re-signed TJ Warren September 2017 to 4 years, $50 million. I don't know, man. It's tough, right? Like, we both are kind of not that high on TJ Warren, mostly because he doesn't shoot threes. I mean, 4 years, $50 million for somebody who can score at least somewhat efficiently. He does have league average or slightly above league average true shooting numbers, despite the fact that he doesn't shoot threes because he gets to the line a lot. So, like, you're only paying him $12 million a year. He's still young and could get better over the life of that contract. It's not terrible. He could be the kind of guy who you're looking to trade again, or looking to trade a year or two into the deal, because it's hard to necessarily see a role for him on the next great Suns team unless it is as like a bit player.
Do you think his contract passes the Nene test right now?
Like, could you trade it for just into someone's cap space? Probably not, because there's so little cap space in the league, but maybe by like this upcoming trade deadline or next summer when the cap space there starts to be a little more, there might be a suitor for TJ Warren. If I were a good team that had a bad bench and had enough flexibility to bring somebody in with his salary, I think TJ Warren makes sense as a guy who you just have run the offense for your bench for like 20 minutes a game.
Yeah, that's actually like a pretty interesting fit for him. You know, he kind of does that for the Suns currently even, you know.
Yep.
I gave that contract a C just because I feel like there could be surplus value generated. Because I think there's a non-zero chance that TJ Warren like just like learns how to shoot, makes a leap, and suddenly we're talking about TJ Warren as like a fringe all-star someday. Like, when you can just like score the way TJ Warren can, like, you can never rule that out. But I think that's very unlikely, but it is possible. So like, I understand what they see in TJ Warren. I understand the idea. I don't think it's a great contract. And I think if they'd just not given him an extension and they'd held him till the summer, I think he would get less than that this summer, which is why ultimately it's hard to like that move that much.
Yep. Then on October 22nd, just a couple days into the season, was still extremely fresh. The Suns made Earl Watson the first fired coach of the 2017-2018 campaign. Which is mostly just weird because it's like, why did you let this guy run your training camp and like work with your players all summer and come in with everyone expecting he was going to be the coach if he had such a short leash that you're going to fire him 3 games into the year? Like, what changed during those 3 games where you can no longer trust Earl Watson to run the team? I have no idea, obviously not there behind the scenes, but it just doesn't project well or speak well to the Suns being a well-running franchise. And that stuff matters when you talk about trying to, like, you know, get free agents in the mix and just relationships with agents, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it really strikes me as a classic, like, reactionary move. And you never want to be making, reactionary moves rarely work out, you know? I mean, the Suns were embarrassing those first 3 games. You know, they lost multiple games by, like, 40 points. Like, it truly was, like, the most embarrassing opening stretch to a season I can ever remember for a team.
Yep, that's true.
But it's still reactionary to fire the coach that quickly. And so it's tough. Like, maybe they were low on Earl Watson for a while, and this was like the straw that broke the camel's back. But then they should have fired him a long time ago. Because like we're saying, like with coaches, you either need to be all the way in and being fully patient, or once you've given up, like they need to go. And so I'm happy the Suns fired Watson quickly if they were just like ready for him to go. But why was he around for training camp and everything, like you said?
Like, yeah, it's also like, if I were this guy, Igor, who were just hired by them, I couldn't help but be thinking in the back of my mind, how much time do I really have here? You know, that's right. Part of my concern, right? Is you want, just in general, you want people to think that you're operating with them in good faith. I mean, the Suns offered their head coaching job, supposedly, at least this was what was reported. They offered their job to David Fizdale, and he said no. How much of that has to do with the way that they've yanked coaches around in the past and the fact that Fizdale wants to go somewhere where he thinks he can get a sure 3 years?
Yeah, totally possible. I mean, I just think... Yeah, and also, like, I mean, they made Jay Toronto the interim head coach, and he spent an entire year coaching the team, which is fine, except it's really like your team, like, doesn't have a coherent head coach for an entire year because there's not a guy with a long-term plan, you know?
And that's a year, crucial year for Devin Booker. And it's rookie year for Josh Jackson, big year for Ben. I mean, all these guys that they still hope turned into solid guys, this was kind of a lost year for them.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean,
the one thing that they did manage to get the absolute worst record, number one most ping pong balls in the draft lottery. And yes, so that we have to give them credit for that, huge. Commend that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Once again, because that is so important. Because, once again, the draft, it's all just a numbers game, and you get the most value from having the highest pick possible, and doing that is just, it's so important, and very few things are more important than that.
Especially during this year with the old lottery odds, where they're sloped a little more than they're going to be starting next year.
Yeah, dude, I think that's the most overblown story in the NBA right now, is this idea that the new lottery reform actually changes any of the incentive structure. It just makes it so you get less of a payoff, but it's still so valuable to be the worst team in the league. You know, because the reality is they pick four, you know, instead of picking 3 teams in the lottery, they're going to pick 4 now, but that guarantees the worst pick you get is the 5th pick instead of the 6th pick. And each pick, the incremental value decreases significantly. And so I just...
The fact that they can't go any lower than the 4th pick, and that's pretty huge. And even if the lottery odds were structured differently, that would still be a big deal. I get what you're saying.
Yeah, and I mean, if the NBA really wanted to transform like the lottery incentives, they would pick every team. It would be like you would have the lottery odds, they would have the ping pong balls and everything, and just 1 through 14 would be selected. So it's possible that the team with the first pick could end up with the worst record could end up with like the 9th pick. You know, statistically unlikely, but possible. And that would really be a big step towards reducing the incentive structure. But I don't think it's changed that much based on making it so they pick 4 teams and there's only a 14% chance of getting the top pick. It strikes me as a half measure that doesn't actually change anything.
Yeah, but we'll see how it plays out once the season's actually going on. I mean, this is something I imagine we'll probably talk about ad nauseum on this podcast, but I don't think there's anything you can do. The issue is that basketball, more than any other sport, one player can change your team so much that teams are always going to tank.
Yep. Yeah, I agreed completely.
So you want to just wrap up these last couple trades they made during the season this year, and then we can call it.
So November 7th, they traded Eric Bledsoe for Greg Monroe and the Bucks first. That was
basically just a first, right? They bought out Greg Monroe, or did? Yeah.
Yeah, they bought out Greg Monroe. He ended up, he actually stayed there for a while, and they bought him out, and he went to Boston. But the 2018, the first was really interesting because it was, what exactly was it? It was 1 through 11 protected, and then 17 through 30 protected. So it only conveyed if it was 12 through 16 this year. And then next year it only conveys if it's top 3 protected, and then it's top 17, like it's 17 through 30 again.
Okay, so it's...
And then it becomes... It just has really quirky protections. I don't have them up right now, unfortunately. But it's one of those examples where that pick, the way the protections are set up, it has huge variance. That pick could end up being a really, really good pick someday, or it could end up being like the 26th pick in the draft, and that's not great value for
Bledsoe. I mean, at this point, as long as Giannis is healthy and playing on the Bucks, it's probably not going to be a great pick. But I guess you're kind of partially what you're paying for if you're the Suns is the chance that either he leaves or is unhealthy.
Gets injured. So. Yeah. And that's just, once again, the upside value is so important. And then, so I gave that trade a B+. I like that return for Bledsoe.
I mean, especially given, like, he had already tweeted, I don't want to be here. Like, if you're getting a first-round pick or even a heavily protected first-round pick for a guy who publicly doesn't want to be on your team, it's a good move.
Well, I don't want a guy on my team who doesn't like being at the hairdresser. You know, I think that says a lot about a man if he's not willing to be at the hairdresser with his significant other.
Right. That was famously Bledsoe's explanation for that tweet that had nothing to do with the Suns, and, of course, he just didn't want to be with his wife getting her haircut. So if you believe that, then, all right, you came to the right place.
And then on February 8th, 2018, they traded a second round pick to the Magic for Elfrid Payton. It ends up being the 41st pick in the draft this year. Give this trade a C+. I like get the idea of trading for Elfrid Payton, seeing what you have in them, you know, seeing how he meshes with Booker, because there's an idea that like Payton could be a menace on defense and really cover for the flaws of Booker. And like Booker's shooting could help mitigate the flaw of Payton not being a great shooter. And the 41st pick isn't that valuable of a second. You know, it's really at that point where the second round starts to dip.
I'd give that trade like a B or a B plus. I think I'd rather have, I mean, now, well, it's still, jury's still out until we see what contract Payton signs this offseason. It's tough, right? If Payton leaves too, I mean, he's restricted, but if he were to go somewhere else, then they basically just gave up the 41st pick for nothing. But assuming that Payton's actually in the fold next year, which they got to bring him back because of trading that asset. I mean, I think that he could help be kind of steady at least and has still some room for growth. He's certainly better than any of their other point guard options right now.
Yeah, I do worry. You talked a little about how they have to bring him back because they trade an asset for him. I mean, I worry a little about the Payton contract with the Suns because I worry they're going to fall for that like sunk cost fallacy. Like that second round pick is a sunk cost at this point. You know, they should just act like it doesn't, like never happened. And then they just need to evaluate Elfrid Payton based on what he's worth now. But I do worry that the Suns are an organization that things like sunk costs really do matter. And so they're going to think like, oh, well, we have to bring him back and we have to match this contract that we don't like that much because we traded a second. And that's where this trade could become a really bad outcome for the Suns.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Hopefully, I mean, I don't think Elfrid Payton's going to be making more than like $5 or $6 million a year, but if I'm wrong, then I will change my tone.
Yeah, definitely. I have one other thing I want to mention. It's a tangent from the Suns. Have you listened to the Bill Simmons, David Griffin podcast
yet? I have not listened to that, but if you recommend it, I'll check it out.
It was pretty good. There was one interesting part, though, that David Griffin talks about, and it's one of these things that this gets talked about all the time, and it's irked me for a long time. They were talking about the Mozgov trade, how the Cavs sent 2 firsts for Mozgov, and David Griffin tries to argue that it wasn't really sending 2 firsts because it was really sending the Memphis pick they already had and then the pick they got for Deion Waiters, and so it doesn't count as 2 firsts.
Meh.
That's just not the way asset evaluation works. Like, you can't just, like, no, you traded 2 firsts for Timothy Mozgov. Like, at that point, like, you had the decision whether to hold on to 2 first-round picks or have Timothy Mozgov on your team. And to, like, evaluate this, like, and, Mike Lombardi talks a lot about on the Ringer NFL show that this is the way NFL teams evaluate draft picks too. Like if you trade down and you pick up picks or whatever, like those are viewed as like extra picks, and suddenly they're like less valuable than your own priorly.
Yeah, that's such broken logic. Like a pick is a pick. It doesn't matter how you got it.
A pick is a pick. Yep. And I think that's like something that I think teams, that's a classic example of like faulty logic that a lot of teams fall into. And I just thought that it really runs counter to what we're really trying to support here. So I want to point that out. Though I felt like, I was really blown away. I thought David Griffin came off as really, really smart. And you totally get why people in the media just like rave about him and really like him. But that was one thing that stuck out to me. I was just like, that's just not how things actually work. That's not the way asset like acquisition and, you know, exchange works.
Totally agree. All right, so that's every move the Suns have made since like 2012. Really paints a picture of a franchise that, I mean, the biggest issue is a lot of the time they haven't known what they want. And if your goals are moving constantly as a franchise, or if you're not internally consistent, then it can really set your rebuild back. So that being said, we're more optimistic about the Suns than we are about any of our other truly horrible teams, mostly because they have drafted reasonably.